There is sort of an on-screen sewing circle going on at the multiplex these days. The title character in Coco Before Chanel, which opened this past weekend, is a budding fashion designer. The leading lady of Bright Star is a poet's muse who designed her own clothes a century earlier. And for accessorizing, you can't top the editors of Vogue in the September issue. Bob Mondello says that while Hollywood often falls for fashion, the fall this fall feels a little different.
Perhaps because movie stars love fashion, films love fashion. Films like Clueless.
What the hell is that?
A dress.
Says who?
Calvin Klein.
Confessions of a Shopaholic.
Gucci boots!
I saw him first.
The Devil Wears Prada.
Jimmy Choo's. Another Blahnik.
Not to mention Bruno.
What type belt is that, candidate?
D&T.
What is D&G?
Dolce & Gabbana, hello?
Name-dropping, though, is what those of us who watch movies do. Designer gowns created for high society have always been something most folks could only dream about, and that's where Hollywood comes in. It is a dream factory, remember? As early as the Great Depression, long before Project Runway or even TV, Tinseltown brought the fashion runway to your neighborhood cinema.
A little peep into the coming season. And a glimpse of the future, too. Lumière, musique.
As she stepped away, curtains parted, and 1939's black and white comedy, The Women, exploded into color for a 6-minute fashion parade. There were lots of movie moments like that for a while. Jane Russell sang her way down the runway in The French Line. Audrey Hepburn struck poses for fashion photographer Fred Astaire in Funny Face. And for a really bizarre variation on the theme, Federico Fellini offered up a papal fashion show in Roma. Nuns parading in basic black, roller skating cardinals in red, and fur-trimmed, jewel-encrusted, electric-stained glass robes for the Pope looking to make a really bold fashion statement. All of this was mockery of one sort or another, as were most movies centered on fashion models. The 1970s thriller Lipstick didn't mean to ridicule its leading lady, but it was hard to take Margot Hemingway too seriously as she raced around in a scarlet evening gown she had accessorized with a rifle. She was bringing down a rapist who'd been freed by the courts, but while there is an occasional model as social crusader flick, think Diana Ross railing at an all-white fashion industry in Mahogany.
I've been told what I can't do, where I can't go, and why I can't be different from anybody else.
The more usual approach is to show models as the dimmest of dim bulbs, as in Zoolander.
Do you ever think that maybe there's more to life than being really, really, really ridiculously good-looking?
All of which suggests that Hollywood assumes audiences don't take fashion very seriously. But in recent years, that assumption's been changing. The 1990s documentary Unzipped surprised even its producers by raking in millions while making a pop figure of designer Isaac Mizrahi. This year's Valentino, The Last Emperor, and September issue look at the business strategies that rule the fashion world because fashion is big business, big enough that Hollywood wants to piggyback on its appeal, especially after a blockbuster has offered a tutorial in why people should care, as The Devil Wears Prada did, when Anne Hathaway let slip to fashion editor Meryl Streep that she wasn't much interested in couture.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you. You go to your closet and you select, I don't know, that lumpy blue sweater, for instance, because you're trying to tell the world that you take yourself too seriously to care about what you put on your back. But what you don't know is that that sweater is not just blue, it's not turquoise, it's not lapis, it's actually cerulean. And you're also blithely unaware of the fact that in 2002, Oscar de la Renta did a collection of cerulean gowns. And then I think it was Yves Saint Laurent, wasn't it, who showed cerulean military jackets? I think we need a jacket here.
Mm.
And then cerulean quickly showed up in the collections of 8 different designers. And then it filtered down through the department stores and then trickled on down into some tragic casual corner where you no doubt fished it out of some clearance bin. However, that blue represents millions of dollars and countless jobs. And it's sort of comical how you think that you've made a choice that exempts you from the fashion industry when in fact you're wearing a sweater that was selected for you by the people in this room.
Clear? Well, if not, you must not have been watching TV's Project Runway or caught the $400 million migration of Sex and the City to the multiplex. The fashion industry may be taking a recessionary hit at the department store, but on screen, it's boom time, with audiences apparently as intrigued by couture as the stars who walk the red carpet on Oscar night. I'm Bob Mandela.
Red is dead, blue is through, green's obscene, brown's taboo, and there is not the slightest excuse for plum abuse or chartreuse. Think pink, forget that Dior says black and rust. Think pink, who cares if the new look has no bust? Now, I wouldn't presume to tell a woman what a woman ought to think, but tell her if she's gotta think. Think pink.
For pants, pink for shoes.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. $307 billion. That's how much Americans gave to charity last year. This year's number is expected to be smaller, and 2010 isn't looking so great for nonprofits either. From Seattle, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
The downtown YWCA is a safe haven for women and their children. They can make meals, sit at a comfy kitchen table, and talk about regular stuff, like Halloween costumes. Scary isn't the word the YWCA's chief executive uses to describe her budget crunch, but Sue Sherbrook comes close to it.
We're concerned about how we're going to end the year. We have $633,000 to raise, and there are women and families in our two counties are really depending on us to do it, and we're worried.
And the YWCA isn't alone. Overall, charitable giving fell roughly 6% last year after adjusting for inflation. That's the steepest drop in decades, and this year giving will likely be down again. So far, there have been just two marquee gifts of $100 million or more. Last year, there were 20. Donations by the rest of us are also down. Some people who used to give at the office no longer have jobs. Others, like Carol Pinky, saw their retirement funds take a hit. And they scaled back.
I have regular charities I support. They always try to add something new every year, and last year I just didn't.
In fact, Panky actually cut the number of charities she supported and gave her money only to those who had earned her loyalty and trust. That response has been fairly typical, suggests Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. She says now more than ever, organizations have to court their contributors and show them how the money will be spent.
One of the things charities are trying to do is make it more concrete. They might say, if you spend $25, you can buy 5 minutes, 10 minutes, a half hour of a scientist's time, instead of just saying, it'd be nice to cure cancer.
Or feed the hungry, or provide job training. Donors also want to see tangible results from the groups they're supporting. Increasingly, charitable organizations are using tools such as Facebook and Twitter to convey their messages and solicit funds, but most requests for money are still done the old-fashioned way. Asking for money has never been easy, and right now, many charities are nervous about offending people by making a request.
There's a lot of fear out there. There has been for a year.
But Leanne Moss, executive director of the Women's Funding Alliance, knows the only way she could meet the needs of women and girls was to ask for money, sometimes boldly.
It's about being focused on that mission. And I've been in situations in the past where, yes, I have made too large of an ask and had to do a little repair. But in the end, people have respected me and us more for doing that.
Looking ahead to an improving economy, experts believe that individual donations will pick up first, foundation dollars will follow. Overall, says Stacey Palmer of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, the outlook isn't very pretty.
It's going to be very, very hard for groups to be able to raise money. They'll be in a squeeze. So I think it's going to be quite a long time till most nonprofit groups can come out of this.
How long will it take? History suggests 2 or 3 years before charitable giving returns to pre-recession levels. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News, Seattle.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
NASA's spacecraft have traveled all over our solar system, and for that you can thank plutonium. Not the kind used in bombs, rather a special kind of plutonium that NASA uses to power space probes that venture far from the sun. Trouble is, supplies of this fuel are running out. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports.
The kind of plutonium used for nuclear weapons is plutonium-239. NASA uses something different, plutonium-238. A marshmallow-sized pellet of this stuff, encased in metal, gives off a lot of heat.
If you dim the lights a little bit, it glows a little red, because it's very hot.
Stephen Johnson works on space power systems at the Idaho National Laboratory. He says all that heat can be converted into electricity.
And this electricity is very, very useful when you're in a remote or a hostile environment, such as when you're in space and when you're too far away from the sun to use solar power.
Since 1961, about 24 space missions have used this fuel. Without it, NASA could not have sent out the famous Voyager probes in the 1970s. It could not have launched the Cassini spacecraft, which is orbiting Saturn right now and sending back gorgeous images of the planet's rings. So plutonium-238 is seriously important for planetary science, but NASA is running out. Ralph McNutt is a researcher at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. He says this material was a byproduct of Cold War activities, and the U.S. hasn't made any new supplies since the 1980s.
We've been living off of the material that we had produced up until that time, and if you keep using material and you have a finite supply, eventually you run out, and that's where we are right now.
For a while, we could buy some from Russia, but they're out too. McNutt says NASA has enough for its next Mars rover, the next planned trip to the outer planets, and one more mission designed to use a small amount of the fuel. And that's about it.
It's kind of like having a car, and if all the gasoline stations are closed and are out of gasoline, and you're out of gas, you're not going to go anywhere.
He says we could still explore places close enough to the sun for solar panels to work, but for going far out into space, there is no substitute for plutonium-238.
There isn't any other option.
McNutt co-chaired a committee of the National Research Council that issued a report in May. It said the shortage has already forced NASA to delay some missions and limit others. And even if the Department of Energy restarts production now, it would still take 8 years to ramp up to making the 11 pounds or so needed by NASA each year. This report seemed to get people's attention. And the administration's budget request for next year included $30 million to move towards new production.
For us, that was a major step forward, a very positive thing for both NASA and Department of Energy.
Hal Bell is director for the Advanced Planning and Analysis Division at NASA headquarters.
Previously, we had not seen that level of commitment.
But over the summer, as a big appropriations bill made its way through Congress, the Senate knocked the amount down to zero, and the House lowered it to just $10 million. Planetary scientists can now only wait to see what happens. Less money would mean more delay. Alan Stern says that would be a setback for NASA.
It really is the kind of thing where people will wake up 10 years from now and say, what were they thinking?
Stern works at the Southwest Research Institute in Colorado and is chief scientist for NASA's New Horizons probe. It's out past Saturn, headed to Pluto.
Our mission is a good example. We're going to Pluto in the Kuiper Belt, where the sunlight is 1,000 times lower and the temperatures are close to absolute zero.
He says this mission could not have happened without plutonium-238. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. The housing market appears to be stabilizing, but just barely. And many realtors are complaining about new regulations that are causing headaches for home buyers. The problem, they say, is home appraisals. The new rules were intended to get more accurate and unbiased estimates of home values, but many in the industry say the rules are having unintended consequences that are gumming up the works. Here's NPR's Chris Arnold.
In a townhouse in Framingham, Massachusetts, home appraiser Ken McDonough is about to crawl up into the attic.
Call it a drop stair attic.
He's folding stairways up to the attic here.
They want you to see if there's insulation, and they want you to observe the roof.
from the inside to see if there's any water damage.
Anytime somebody buys a house or refinances, somebody like McDonough has to show up, measure the square footage, see how new the kitchen is, and go on a little safari hunt looking for problems. McDonough, with his tape measure and pencil, checks the furnace room, the bathrooms.
It's just, don't miss anything.
Appraisals are a cornerstone of the whole housing market. But right now, many realtors and mortgage brokers are complaining that problems with appraisals are delaying sales and refinances. Many blame new regulations for tangling things up. The National Association of Mortgage Brokers estimates that this is actually costing homeowners upwards of $2 billion collectively, and it definitely isn't helping the housing recovery.
Okay, first things first, let me pull this and I'll be back to you in a bit.
Paul Van Wart is a mortgage broker in Westwood, Massachusetts. He gets off the phone with a new customer and says a lot of appraisals these days are coming in at values that are way too low. And they're often full of mistakes, which he says creates big headaches for home buyers.
Once it gets to an underwriter, the underwriter tears the appraisal apart and says, well, I need the appraiser now to comment on this, go back and do this. Then we can't meet the closing date. We have to extend their rate. Okay, there's a cost to extend an interest rate. The borrower is going to pay that. And on a $200,000 loan, that's going to be $1,500. Okay.
At the next desk over, Nicole Rubino says she remembers one couple who was buying a house and planning on moving in the next day. They had no place else to live, and an appraisal problem just barely got sorted out at the very last minute, literally just minutes before the closing deadline.
And of course, that infuriates everyone involved. You have a closing attorney who's upset. You have buyers who are, you know, out of their minds because they're got moving vans, you know, and oh, she was so out of her mind.
Van Wart puts a big part of the blame on what's called the Home Valuation Code of Conduct. During the housing boom, some appraisers broke the rules. Mortgage brokers pressured them to inflate home values so the brokers could get more loans approved and make more money. And that left a lot of people stuck, having borrowed more than their house was worth. So a few months ago, new regulations went into effect to prevent that. But even a lot of appraisers say the new rules are causing all kinds of problems.
It's horrible.
Can we set your solicitation for a property?
Back at his home office, the appraiser Ken McDonough has a message on his answering machine about an appraisal job. It used to be that he'd get these calls from mortgage brokers. But since the new rules took effect,
my mortgage brokers, who I built up relationships with over many, many years, they can't call me anymore and ask me to do work for them.
The rules insist on a firewall. Mortgage brokers cannot deal directly with appraisers. So these days, many lenders have turned to middlemen called appraisal management companies. They now get paid by the lenders to hire the appraisers. And so here's the problem. McDonough says those companies will sign up just about any appraiser that they can find who will do the appraisal on the cheap, even if they don't know the area very well and don't have much experience.
For the appraisal management company, that's what it's all about. When they send an appraisal assignment to a dozen appraisers or more and say, hey, the first guy that takes it for $200, they're obviously bottom fishing.
The appraisal management companies say they are not to blame. Don Blanchard is an attorney with Lender Processing Services, which works with 20,000 appraisers.
The average tenure of our appraisers on our panel of appraisers is 13 years. So we think we have very good coverage and experienced appraisers, as opposed to a lot of the sort of anecdotal criticisms that you hear.
Blanchard also says that home prices are just especially hard to estimate accurately right now. And he thinks some of the frustrations are due to just falling home prices, not bad appraisals. Meanwhile, regulators say they're working to tweak the rules. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. As Congress considers changes to the health care system, we've been taking a look at the health insurance we have now. Our series is called Are You Covered? And this morning we report on people who technically are covered but realistically are not. Up to 37 million people have coverage that's full of holes. We have two reports this morning, starting with NPR's Richard Knox with a family that is underinsured.
Jim and Martha Martin and their dog Abby get up before the sun rises. By 5 a.m., Martha's already on fast forward. She has a very busy life.
We're both working so many jobs that about the only time we ever sit down together is to breakfast.
There's not much time when I'm not at work.
Breakfast is when they talk about money and bills, especially medical bills. Sometimes their daughters Sarah and Rebecca overhear them.
I think the girls are sleeping and they hear what we talk about sometimes if they're awake.
The girls' bedrooms are right above the kitchen. 19-year-old Sarah says she and Rebecca, who's 14, sometimes get upset by what they hear.
You feel guilty being their kid and, you know, kind of saying, hey, I wish I could get money somewhere so that I could, you know, help you out with that. Mm-hmm. And you just, I don't know, you feel guilty.
Martha says that hurts, but she and Jim can't hide the fact that they're constantly struggling with medical bills. Even though they work 5 jobs between them and have some health insurance, the bills pile up. Just before 7, Jim heads off to work. Martha goes into her small home office. She pulls out a big fat folder marked medical bills.
Well, these are all the places that I owe money to, bills that I owe that the insurance did not pay.
The Martins are basically healthy, but last year Rebecca had to have a major operation, and her insurance policy was lousy.
We got a bill from the anesthesiologist. We got a bill from the hospital. We got a bill from the surgeon. We got a bill from the blood work people. We got a bill for the ultrasound. You get to a point where you just feel like you're just a general feeling of overwhelmness.
When Martha gets anxious, Jim calms her down. After 23 years of marriage, they've worked out their roles. She frets, he reassures. She makes phone calls to set up payment plans. He writes the checks. For more than a decade, Jim's worked at a boatyard building sleek kayaks and canoes. He makes $16 an hour.
So on the deck, you can just cut that down the middle.
But recently, the boatyard got new owners. They've cut his hours, and the company doesn't provide health insurance for part-timers.
My insurance expired August 31st.
Jim also works part-time at Walmart, but he's not eligible for insurance there yet. He says being without insurance doesn't bother him too much. To take his mind off things, he gets outside and hikes up mountains.
My grandfather dropped dead at the age of 58, but he didn't take care of himself. And, you know, I like to think I'm doing things better, healthy-wise, than the generation before me. And maybe that's my insurance, is to stay active.
So if you should have an accident, what would happen?
I don't know. I do possess faith in God, and I don't get too caught up in the larger, you know, too far ahead. It's just day to day, week to week, month to month.
Martha, on the other hand, worries about what they'd do if Jim got sick or hurt. Not only would they lose his income, but they wouldn't be able to pay the medical bills. Around noon, Martha gets into her blue minivan to go to one of her 3 part-time jobs doing home help for the elderly. She spent the morning at an appointment with her daughter, Rebecca.
Well, we just went and had our intake appointment to see the new counseling place. And they said
the 14-year-old's been dealing with anxiety and depression. Martha's been worried about the cost of counseling, but today she's got some good news.
Oh, my gosh, there's a grant, and a grant for children in Maine. And I was like, yes, so we get free counseling care.
At the same time, it upset her to hear what the counselor had to say.
One of Rebecca's major reasons for depression is because she feels like every time she has a medical issue, it generates a bill which she knows we can't pay.
Martha says it's hard to keep her perspective when it comes to Rebecca's problems.
Because you always want to, you know, wave your magic mom wand, and fairy dust comes out and it makes life easy for them.
It's time for Martha's shift at the supermarket. She's the chipper lady behind the deli counter. She's worked in food service for years.
Would you guys like a piece of cheese? Bologna.
She loves her customers, but she's 52 and the job is taking a toll.
My hands hurt. My feet hurt. You know, I'm getting older. I'm finding that, you know, moving the slicers to clean under them and lifting the heavy things of meat. But I took this because it was offered insurance.
But the policy she has is very limited. It covers only her, and every time she needs care, she's left with a big share of the cost. After her shift, Martha comes back to her little house at the end of a country lane. It's bright pink.
Oh, I do have a pink house.
It's very cheerful. Is this a Mary Kay color?
Yeah, it's Dusty Rose Lipstick.
Mary Kay Cosmetics Consultant. That's another one of Martha's part-time jobs.
Originally, the idea was that my Mary Kay customers would be able to find me easier because everybody couldn't find the house.
The little pink house holds a collection of antique furniture and blue pattern china that her parents spent a lifetime collecting. They died last year. Martha started selling some of these antiques to keep up with the bills.
And, you know, it is just stuff. I mean, it's emotional stuff, but it's just stuff, and it's not as important as the people. But once it's gone, it's, you know, gone, and I can't get it back.
But Martha doesn't have much choice. More medical bills are coming, and she needs to have a hysterectomy next month. Insurance will pay only $1,000 of the hospital bill. So for the Martins, 2009 is looking a lot like 2008.
45% of our income last year went for medical bills and health insurance premiums. 45%. That's just crazy. I mean, I don't pay that much in taxes. So I just think that there should be a health insurance plan out there that everybody can sign up for.
Martha Martin says she'd be happy to pay the premiums if only she could get decent coverage. Richard Knox, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block. The remake of the 1980 film Fame opened in theaters this weekend. But unlike other high school musicals, this one has its roots in a real-life setting, the Fiorello H. LaGuardia High School of Music and Art and Performing Arts in New York City. Lara Pellegrinelli visited the prestigious school to hear what its students think about their glamorous Hollywood proxies.
Students at LaGuardia usually embrace the spotlight, but maybe not this week. Practically everyone's got an opinion on the original film, including drama major Azora Howard.
Fame is nice and the dancing on the cabs is nice, but this is a very, very serious arts institution.
So what is it really like to go to LaGuardia?
The next one is...
My day began at 8 a.m. in AP Calculus.
It looks like this, the limit as x approaches c of f of x raised to the K power.
We really are strong academic students, and we spend so much time devoting ourselves and balancing, learning how to balance the art world and the academic world, and I think that's one of the most valuable lessons that we can learn here.
Lucy Partman is an art major. She and Taylor Patterson are both seniors and plan to go to college when they graduate next spring.
Senioritis, not for us. Like, nope. Nuh-uh. Like, I have... Yeah, 3 APs, 2 APs, like honors, like these crazy classes.
10 periods.
10 periods a day when you could have like
two
academics.
And we start from 8 o'clock and we go to 4 o'clock.
8 to 4.
With
rehearsal. With rehearsal, yeah. I don't get home till 7 because I have rehearsal for the musical every day, which started on the second day of school.
Long days and hard work were common for all the students I spoke with. Samantha Barriento, Carlos Kerr Jr., Paul Reagan, Lionel Christian, and Julian Langford. Not counting rehearsals and extra training after school, the teens spend at least 3 periods a day studying their chosen fields, like this modern dance class for freshmen.
Pelvis finish really clearly one.
If LaGuardia students weren't responsible, dedicated, and talented, the school wouldn't have such a long list of successful alumni. Actors Wesley Snipes and Adrian Brody, architect Charles Guathme, TV producer Stephen Bochco, songwriter Suzanne Vega, dancer Desmond Richardson, and novelist Erica Jong, to name a few. According to Principal Kim Bruno, the film production team that briefly visited wasn't interested in much about the real School of the Arts. She would have liked Debbie Allen, who plays your fictional counterpart, Principal Sims, to stop by and see how the job is really done.
Debbie Allen, my door is open. Come and be principal for a day at LaGuardia, the real Fame School.
For NPR News, I'm Lara Pellegrinelli in New York.